Hey, you're listening to the Takeaway Special President's Day podcast on executive power.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening to this President's Day special. Before we get to some of the issues raised by our current president, let's note that Americans have been discussing how this country should be led, how the role of a chief executive should be designed, for a very long time. George Washington even mentioned it when he said,
"If in the opinion of the people, the distribution or modification of the constitutional powers be in any particular wrong, let it be corrected by an amendment in the way which the Constitution designates. But let there be no change by usurpation. For though this, in one instance, may be the instrument of good, it is the customary weapon by which free governments are destroyed."
Here's the issue again in the mega-popular Broadway show Hamilton. You can hear a very modern rendition of a very old debate.
"Stand with me in the land of the free. Pray to God we never see Hamilton's candidacy. Look, when Britain taxed our tea, we got frisky. Imagine what gonna happen when you try to tax our whiskey."
"Thank you, Secretary Jefferson. Secretary Hamilton, your response."
"Thomas, that was a real nice declaration. Welcome to the present, we're running a real nation. Would you like to join us? Or stay mellow doing whatever the hell it is you do in Monticello? If
we assume..." Americans have never fully resolved who will lead this democracy. We are taught to hate kings and monarchs, right? We fought a war against King George. Yet today the Brits are among our closest allies, and we follow the royals almost as much as the readers of the London tabloids. We have our Camelot in the Kennedys. Bush has a dynasty. A pair of Roosevelts and Adamses have occupied the White House. That's a little suspicious. Congress is supposed to be the grand voice of the people, but it can also be so annoying and slow. Military dictatorships, we all agree that's a horrible idea. Yet, Washington and Eisenhower, Grant and Jackson were all military generals, controversial in their time. Jimmy Carter deferred to Congress, and he's considered a softy. George W. Bush changed laws with his own signing statements, with Dick Cheney always mysteriously lurking there in the background. Obama, and so far Donald Trump, have made executive orders practically an alternative Congress. What kind of president do we really want, and how are we going to get it? Today we're dedicating our entire show to this question. We will journey from George Washington to Andrew Jackson, from Abraham Lincoln to Theodore Roosevelt, and Woodrow Wilson and beyond. Many of these Oval officers have admitted to struggling mightily with the experience of exercising extraordinary powers and have issued grave warnings to us, like this famous one from General Eisenhower.
"In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex."
Other presidents have expressed power frustrations.
"My strong preference has always been to legislate when I can get legislation done."
Or simply became personally overwhelmed by the power itself, as Lyndon Johnson did.
"Accordingly, I shall not seek and I will not accept the nomination of my party for another term as your president."
This hour, we'll explore all of this and we'll ask our experts how they would suggest redesigning the system if they could. Eric Posner, professor of law at the University of Chicago, is our first companion this hour, who says that the founders did want a strong president, but maybe not quite as strong as we are experiencing right now.
"The founders wanted a strong leader, a strong chief executive, because they believed a strong chief executive was necessary to protect the country from foreign enemies. But they were worried that a strong leader would become a dictator. There were many historical examples from Caesar to Cromwell. So they also created other institutions that were designed to check the president, the most important of which were Congress and the judiciary. The president today is much more powerful than George Washington was, or nearly any of the presidents of the 19th century, with the exception of Lincoln, who was a special case. So the growth of presidential power has been fairly rapid, starting in the early 20th century. But Congress continues to check the president by using oversight hearings and refusing to pass laws that the president wants. And the courts also will sometimes block the president from acting, as we've just seen with Trump's travel ban.
What does the Constitution specifically say about this concept of executive power? Is there language that kind of gets the ball rolling?
Yes, in Article 2, Section 1 of the Constitution, the first sentence is, "The executive power shall be vested in a president of the United States of America."
I guess we've taken it quite a ways from there.
It depends what executive power means. And the founders themselves didn't define the term in the document. And it wasn't clear that they really agreed on what it meant. Probably it included the power to conduct foreign relations. And it also probably included the power to enforce the laws that were passed by Congress. But what it might include beyond that was never made clear.
What would the framers, do you think, say about the language that's used very casually, really since the end of World War II, that the president of the United States is the leader of the free world, or has the most powerful job in the world, or is the most powerful man in the world? What would the framers think of that?
I think they would have disagreed about it. I mean, some of the framers, like Alexander Hamilton and John Adams, they were looking forward to a very powerful president, maybe even almost like a monarch. And all of the founders, or most of the founders, were looking forward to a time where the United States would be a great empire. So I think they might have been pleased at the thought that the president would in the future be called the leader of the free world. On the other hand, the reigning ideology at the time, the kind of official ideology of the founders, was that of republicanism, which emphasized collective decision-making and was very much opposed to the idea that a single person could be more important than any other. So I think a number of them would have been uncomfortable with this idea of an extremely powerful president.
How would we describe the period from George Washington's famous speech where he stepped down voluntarily, even though he could have probably served for as long as he wanted, to the first big moment of the growth of executive power?
Well, it wasn't a continuous process. There were a number of powerful presidents along the way, including Andrew Jackson and Abraham Lincoln. But probably the beginning of the modern powerful presidency should be dated back to Teddy Roosevelt at the beginning of the 20th century. And then starting with Teddy Roosevelt, a series of very powerful presidents accumulated additional power for the office. And these included Woodrow Wilson and Franklin Roosevelt, of course, who was probably the most important.
What did Jackson do, since you mentioned him at the very beginning?
Jackson is an interesting case. He was one of the first presidents who was truly popular across the country, aside from Washington, of course. And he famously refused to comply with an order of the Supreme Court, and that was the only time that's ever happened. He also shut down the Second Bank of the United States, which was an important institution at the time. Before Jackson, presidents tended to think they could veto a bill only if they thought it was unconstitutional. Jackson started vetoing bills just because he disagreed with them. So he was an important person, but executive power declined after him, at least until Lincoln.
Why did Lincoln do all that he did? He seems to be a president who didn't want to be king, but took enormous powers.
Because a civil war was raging, Lincoln suspended habeas corpus, which is a power that's given to Congress, not to the president. And the effect of that was that it allowed him to impose martial law so that the military could arrest people and hold them and did not have to bring people before the regular courts. And he did other things that were quite controversial, but his argument was that he needed to do these things in order to preserve the Constitution during a time of civil war. And while a lot of people did object to what he was doing at the time, I think the judgment of history was that he was justified, especially because after the war ended, the president's power reverted to what it had been before. Another notable fact is that Lincoln stood for election in the middle of the Civil War. And this was, in a way, as dramatic as George Washington refusing to serve longer than two terms. In many systems, even democratic systems, it's understood that the leader, if a war is taking place, would stay in power until the end of the war, unless, of course, he's incompetent. But Lincoln, even though he actually thought he would lose the election, he refused to suspend it. And that's not the way dictators act.
Woodrow Wilson, I think of him as a kind of technocrat, academic, who had a view of the presidency that was certainly strong, but almost impossible to implement. And indeed, he had all kinds of trouble doing that. And then, of course, he had failing health there in the end. How do you view the Wilson presidency?
He's important because he helped establish this idea, which is sometimes called the idea of the administrative state, which can be contrasted with the founding era idea of separation of powers. And the administrative state is the state in which the president is the leader, and then he has a vast number of regulators who serve underneath him. And those regulators effectively make the law, make most of the law, and also enforce it and even adjudicate the law to some extent, which is in tension with the original idea of separation of powers. Now, Woodrow Wilson's way of thinking about these things did not actually come into place, but with Franklin Roosevelt, it did. It was during the New Deal where we really got this administrative state going.
So FDR's vision of the powerful presidency is actually something that comes from Woodrow Wilson, and the birth of modern conservatism is very much an argument over whether this regulatory state is anything that anyone would ever have wanted in the beginning of the Republic.
That's right. There have been a number of attempts to dismantle the New Deal administrative state that Franklin Roosevelt put into place. And one of the most powerful arguments is that it's inconsistent with the separation of power system put into place by the founders. Now, the courts have rejected that argument over and over and over again, but in terms of political debate, it continues to have importance.
Do political parties see the same way regarding executive power? And down through history, have political parties disagreed about the role of the presidency, or have they just wanted the same powerful job for themselves?
The latter. They have exactly the same mirror view of the presidency, which is that when they hold the presidency, it should be as powerful as possible. And when the other party holds the presidency, it should be weak. And the problem here is that we have a very powerful notion of checks and balances and separation of powers, because that's what the founders created back in the 18th century. But the actual presidency today is very, very different from what they imagined. The president is much more powerful, has much more policy-making authority over domestic issues, you know, the environment and crime and things like that, than the founders expected.
Eric Posner is a professor of law at the University of Chicago. Coming up, we'll talk about the role of president as seen from the judiciary, the Congress, and the military. Plus, later this hour, we'll imagine how we could reinvent our system if we could start all over again. Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution states, in part, it's only the Congress that has the power to declare war, and it's prohibited from financing armies for more than 2 years. Did you know that? Today, Congress hasn't declared a war since the 1940s. Presidents unilaterally have sent troops into combat in modern times more than 120 times, though. And in the case of Vietnam, Iraq, and Afghanistan, far longer than for 2 years. The president commands cruise missiles into the air, dispatches drones to target perceived enemies. The president is at the top of the chain of command. He's got the codes to launch a nuclear weapon. He's the one who the American people have to trust when he stands before us to explain why we are sending Americans into harm's way.
As Commander-in-Chief of the Army and Navy, I have directed that all measures be taken for our defense.
On my orders, coalition forces have begun striking selected targets of military importance to undermine Saddam Hussein's ability to wage war.
At noon today, I sent a message to the Congress about the situation in Korea.
Allied air forces began an attack on military targets in Iraq and Kuwait.
I do not find it easy to send the flower of our youth, our finest young men, into battle.
Today, our armed forces joined our NATO allies in airstrikes against Serbian forces.
Rosa Brooks is a Georgetown law professor. She sees the evolution of military power into a vast territory of executive unilateralism, a gigantic sandbox, so to speak, where the president gets to play almost without any accountability.
The constraints are solely political, essentially. It's not as though somebody's going to go to court and say that war is illegal. People have tried that. The courts have basically said, hey, not our job. This is a matter for the political branches of government. So if you don't like the war your president started, you can vote the bomb out 4 years later. But that's essentially the only remedy that the Constitution provides, other than the hypothetical remedy of Congress could say something like, well, we're not going to fund your war. But given American political culture, that never actually happens. It's just politically impossible for Congress to do that.
So I remember when George W. Bush was there on the pile after 9/11, and, you know, it was very emotional. The entire nation was, you know, kind of relying on George W. Bush to, you know, make the decisions and to figure out how to respond and to be this sort of emotional symbol of our nation and, you know, all the troubles that we were having. But as time went on during the Bush administration, it seemed as though he was either confused about the difference between the president and the commander in chief, or was working very, very hard to confuse all of us about the difference between the commander in chief and the president, or he was relying on a systematic effort down through history to basically really take advantage of this ambiguity that exists between commander-in-chief and president. What do you think?
Every president has tried to do that to some extent because it's just so convenient. Why wouldn't you? That the commander-in-chief power is almost unconstrained, as we've said. And on the other hand, the president's domestic power is very constrained. And so the more things, if you're the president, the more things you can sort of plausibly shovel into the box labeled war, the more power you have domestically as well as internationally. You know, and every now and then, courts have rebuked this. The famous case from the 1950s, Youngstown, Cheat and Tube, where the courts did say, no, Mr. President, you can't seize America's steel mills, and just because you call it part of the war effort. But that's really, really rare. When the president says this is war-related, the judicial checks on the president's power are really, really minimal. Part of the reason that the balance of power between Congress and the president has shifted is that there are real changes in the world that have made the need of the president, at least hypothetically, to act in an emergency is much broader when ballistic missiles can travel across oceans in minutes than it was when it took the British a couple months to get warships across the Atlantic. And so the president can plausibly say much more today than 50 years ago, or certainly than 150 or 200 years ago. The president can say today, hey, look, I have access to information that you people don't have because of the intelligence agencies. And threats can come from all over the place, and you just have to trust me when I say immigration or whatever it may be is connected to a threat to the United States. You just have to trust me. And by and large, the American people and Congress have been pretty willing to trust president after president.
And it's such a matter of kind of culture and style as well. I mean, if you took someone who's 13 years old and didn't study very hard in their social studies class, and put them in front of a lineup where you had LBJ, George W. Bush, Ronald Reagan, Donald Trump, and Harry Truman, and asked the question, which one of these guys used nuclear weapons? Not a one would get it right. Correct?
That's probably true. I think that's probably true. And I think what makes this scarier now, obviously, than this was 100 years ago or 200 years ago, is precisely that we now have nuclear weapons and other technologies that can do widespread and permanent destruction to vast numbers of people and to the environment. That the costs of a mistake when you live in a world, an interconnected, globalized world where you have things like nuclear weapons, the costs of a presidential mistake are now so much higher than they've ever been before.
The presence of nuclear weapons and the popularized notion that there's a guy with the codes that follows the president around has so transformed the presidency that there's this whole carved out executive power called the bomb that is number one, unprecedented, and is this symbol of an absolutely unconstrained president? What do you think of that?
It's a really good question, right? That you have this fearsome power that is placed by our system in the hands of one person with no safeguards. There's no requirement that your entire cabinet has to agree with you. And the whole premise of that, of course, is that a decision about using nuclear weapons would have to be made in a matter of mere minutes, and there's just no time. And so you have to trust this one person, the President of the United States. But obviously, and of course, people have written books and made movies about this problem. That's kind of scary, because what if the person with that awesome power to destroy gets it wrong, or is crazy, or is being blackmailed?
Rosa Brooks, thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
Rosa Brooks is a law professor at Georgetown University and author of How Everything Became War and the Military Became Everything. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckabee. We turn now to the controversial John Yoo, a former official in the Justice Department under George W. Bush. Yoo, you might remember, wrote the torture memos authorizing waterboarding and other so-called enhanced interrogation techniques. Today, Yoo teaches at the University of California at Berkeley and is a scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. He's also the author of Crisis and Command, A History of Executive Power from George Washington to George W. Bush. The idea of national security, he says, inherently inflates executive power.
When you have things like wars, national security threats, that's where the framers expected the presidency to grow. But when it came to things that you could handle with time for deliberation and contemplation, compromise argument, like most domestic affairs, then I think the Congress was supposed to be in the lead, and the president's job was mostly to try to restrain Congress and try to focus on the implementation and execution of the law, of Congress's policy choices.
So where does this leave President Donald Trump in the arc of presidential history?
The best that Trump can hope for in terms of parallels is Andrew Jackson. I think Trump sees himself as Jackson. And so I think Trump believes that he's representing the forgotten American, or Americans who are dispossessed in the political process by elites from the, you know, I guess even then it was the Northeast Corridor, it would have been not called, but it was the Northeast Corridor cities.
Right.
But I think they're actually very different presidents. I mean, Andrew Jackson is a president of America with a big frontier, and there is a big difference between the frontier states and the eastern states. I don't think we're that different and divided a country as we were then.
When you were in the George W. Bush administration, did you personally find yourself having difficulty reconciling the notion of national security as a mission of presidential power and the kinds of things, the values, like, you know, we don't torture and all that sort of thing? Was this a difficult trade-off for you to make? And you were certainly part of some very controversial decisions during the Bush administration. But how does national security warp the notion of the executive?
First of all, all of these things are trade-offs. You're quite right to call it a trade-off. I think that, of course, if there's any perfect policy where we could have perfect security with no infringement of liberties, we should always do it. But unfortunately, at some point, you have trade-offs, as you do in a lot of things in life. And I just want to say thanks for your question. I wouldn't deny that those were there, and in my mind, at least, always present. And as you can tell, I'm a big admirer, fan of President Lincoln. And so I would always be conscious of how much President Lincoln was, beset by doubts on all these decisions that he was making at the time. And I felt the same way, too. I understood Lincoln better, I think, having gone through it. And then the third thing I'd say is I tried to, at least personally, tried to make sure that our government's policies, even when they had to be extreme, were as limited as possible. And it was my hope that we would not ever have to do the broad things that the Lincoln administration had to do in the home front to fight what I first admit was a much greater threat of the Civil War. And I think that, of course, the Bush administration and what it did in response to 9/11 are still controversial issues. But I also thought it was important that our administration go back to the voters as it did in 2004 and, campaign on it and to have the country approve or disapprove what it did, and try to work with Congress as closely as possible so that even though I think that in response to national security emergencies, the executive does have the maximum power under the Constitution that was designed to have, I also think it shrinks once those emergencies are over. So I wanted to – I didn't want us to ever have a sort of permanent national security state or to be fighting putting the government on a permanent war footing. The government's powers can infringe on civil liberties, of course, during wartime. And if it has to, we want it to make it temporary and as minimal as possible.
John Yoo, thank you so much.
Sure. Thank you.
John Yoo is a former official in the Justice Department under George W. Bush.
Over the last several decades, we've seen a judiciary that's become much more protective of its right of judicial review.
Of course, the judiciary is a check on the president. But while the courts established their restraint on presidents in the famous case of Marbury versus Madison in 1803, there were many cases that endorsed slavery. Plessy versus Ferguson created Jim Crow. The case Worcester versus Georgia was defied by President Andrew Jackson, which led to the Trail of Tears relocation atrocity for the Cherokee Nation and other Native Americans. In our time, we've seen the court aggressively restrain George W. Bush's use of Guantanamo Bay. And in recent weeks, we've seen the current administration take on the courts over an immigration ban, with President Trump using Twitter to lash out at the federal judge who first blocked enforcement of the ban, dismissing the opinion of this, quote, so-called judge. Leon Fresco is former Deputy Assistant Attorney General at the Justice Department, where he was head of the Office of Immigration Litigation under the Obama administration. He says the judiciary has become defensive of its powers for good reason.
Over the beginning history of the judiciary, there were many, many more doctrines where the courts would say that there was not judicial reviewability of certain issues, immigration being one of them, foreign policy being another one, and these general large political questions. The courts used to be very careful to say, we don't have authority to review those. Those should be handled by the Congress or by the executive. And what you're seeing now is the courts have been far more assertive in saying that if someone comes to the court with a dispute, the court is going to find a way to at least be some sort of check when they think that a policy that's being challenged is too far out of the norm.
What would you say has changed that story or added to that story in just the last few weeks?
Well, I think that this executive seems to have come to the conclusion that a lot of other executives come into maybe years into their presidency, and that's not the best way to begin a relationship with the other branches of government, the Congress and the courts, because once you begin at that posture, then all of the general modes of cooperation that one would normally seek to benefit from as the president become strained.
In historical terms, has Donald Trump done the FDR, tried to stack the court and go around his frustration with the Supreme Court, and done the kind of up yours to the court that Andrew Jackson did, all in the same first few weeks?
Well, we haven't seen that yet in substance. We've seen some rhetoric that has been unusual. And the problem is, in terms of making these historical comparisons, we never had anything like Twitter where a president could immediately make such comments on the different cases that are happening in the judiciary at any given moment. And so, yes, we've had ebb and flows of these moments, like you said, the court packing in under President Roosevelt and Andrew Jackson, you know, resisting orders of the court. We've had these moments, and it is true that America survives because the checks and balances of power always come back and the institutions always come back to save us. But the courts are to be treated with almost an extreme level of deference and reverence, because if we don't do that and we undermine the institutions of an impartial judiciary, that cuts the very fabric of what is required to have a society that is based on the rule of law. And that's the problem with just the general evolution of where we're headed as a country, irrespective of anything that's happening under this administration, is that when you have levels of confidence in any aspect of the society that are all under 20%, be it the media, the Congress, the courts, the presidency, whatever it is, you know, basically there's no trust in any institution. When you've reached that level, then the fabric that's holding a rule of law society together becomes ever more tenuous.
Leon Fresco, former Deputy Assistant Attorney General at the Justice Department, where he was head of the Office of Immigration Litigation under the Obama administration. Leon Fresco, thanks so much.
Thank you.
In our special look at executive power, by far the most important confrontation has been between Article 1 and Article 2 of the Constitution, Congress and the executive. The purists of the framers wanted the people themselves to be the sovereign in America, but the nation was too big even back then, so a Congress of representatives would stand in for the people. Senator Mike Lee of Utah is one of the lawmakers behind the Article 1 project, an initiative based on the idea that Congress was always meant to be the driving force in federal policymaking. Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick sat down with Senator Lee to find out what the state of the executive power is in the United States right now.
It's enormous. We've been delegating for decades. You know, I wrote a book called Our Lost Constitution. And in that book, I describe these two stacks of documents I have in my office. One stack is just a few inches tall. It's usually a few hundred to a few thousand pages long, and it consists of the laws passed by Congress last year. The other stack is 97,000 pages long. It's 12 or 13 feet tall, and it consists of last year's Federal Register. So you've got two sets of laws, only one of which is made by the people's elected senators and representatives in Congress. The other set is made by men and women who, while well-educated, well-intentioned, hardworking, and highly specialized, don't work for the people because they never stand for election, and that's a problem.
Why is that a problem?
It's my belief that over the course of the last 80 years, you've had houses, senates, and White Houses of every conceivable partisan combination colluding to pass the buck, colluding to delegate away as much of the lawmaking power as possible so that they can get the credit for it when good things happen pursuant to that law. But they can shift the blame always to someone else when it comes to the really difficult task of drawing lines and deciding who is going to end up not liking their treatment they deserve under the law. And that's a problem that I think needs to be discussed more than it is in public.
So let's talk about the history of this a little bit. Most people start this discussion at World War II because that's the last time Congress used its Article I power to declare war. But let's talk about the history of this since World War II. Executive power in the United States versus, if you like, the power of you and your colleagues in Congress, how that's eroded and why. What's your take on the history?
Okay, I actually chart it back slightly earlier. I chart it back to the New Deal era. But James Landis, who was a member of FDR's Brain Trust, helped him devise the modern federal regulatory system. James Landis advised FDR that it would be a good idea to make sure that Congress had the last word, to make sure that new significant bureaucratic rules would have to be affirmatively enacted into law by Congress and signed into law by the president. Now, Landis was right. He was right to recommend that. And for whatever reason, it didn't happen that way. So over the decades that followed, Congress has been delegating away its power. Interestingly, for the first 50 years or so of that process, Congress frequently held a little bit back and would hold back for itself what was called a legislative veto, which said that in some instances, one house of Congress, in other instances, it took both houses of Congress acting jointly, could, without further discussion with the president, just invalidate an executive branch regulation. Those provisions became popular, and there were hundreds of them on the books by the mid-1980s. That's when the Supreme Court stepped in and interrupted that party, and in a case called INS v. Chadha, invalidated the legislative veto, concluding that the legislative veto practice violated Article 1, Section 7, the presentment clause of the Constitution. There were people then who thought that this delegation of lawmaking power would stop because Congress could no longer have the last word. Well, it didn't stop, and in fact, it got worse. Congress went on a feeding frenzy, and so we've actually seen a proliferation of delegated lawmaking power since the mid-1980s.
It's a little counterintuitive. Most people would look at powerful people in Washington and say they want to keep their power, they want to keep their imperatives, they don't want to hand it over to any president or any bureaucrat. So what has been the incentive here for members of Congress to simply wisp it away down to the other side of Pennsylvania Avenue?
Self-protection. People in Congress have tended over the last few decades to develop a stronger desire to protect their own re-election prospects at all costs, such that, you know, I think Madison was right. Madison had good reasons to expect and to assume that members of Congress and officials serving in each branch of the federal government would jealously guard their own power. But I think the part that he didn't anticipate, a feature that wouldn't materialize for another 150 years or so, was this dynamic that I'm describing, the drive for perpetual reelection, the desire to avoid negative publicity at all costs. That's what got us to this point. It's a lot easier to get reelected over and over and over again when you don't have to do hard things, when you don't have to make these difficult line-drawing decisions, and you instead pass it along to someone else.
How do you take it back? How do you look at President Trump, any president, doesn't really matter, any powerful, muscular White House, and take back your power?
The first step, and this is a step I've discussed with President Trump on multiple occasions, and a step I think he agrees with, involves passage of something called the REINS Act. R-E-I-N-S stands for Regulations from the Executive in Need of Scrutiny. Major rules, major regulations, those having a significant economic impact as determined by OMB, would have to go through the Congress, meaning before they could take effect, they would have to be affirmatively approved by Congress and signed into law by the president. So this is not a legislative veto and therefore doesn't violate the presentment clause under Article 1, Section 7, as outlined by INS v. Chadha. It is instead a separate act of lawmaking that would give authority to this new regulation to take effect. That's an important first step and something that I think Republicans and Democrats alike ought to get behind.
Senator Mike Lee of Utah, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick in conversation with Senator Mike Lee of Utah. What do you think? How has your view of presidential power changed?
This is Andrew in Kalamazoo, Michigan. I've been thinking about the executive having too much power for a few years, particularly starting in their knots, but it's always been granted with the axiom that the electorate will choose a reasonable person. Suddenly, those concerns I had at the back of my mind have gotten a lot more acute.
George from Chicago. You know, the executive orders are part of the executive branch. We have equal checks and balances. You look at elections having consequences. Our immigration laws have been changed for 8 years. We're not even applying the law due to executive orders. You get a new president in place. He has the right and he has the obligation to fix that system.
If a Democratic president issues an executive order, the media is on his side. There's something wrong with the courts. If a Republican president makes an executive order, the media is against him, and there's something wrong with the president. The media's got more power than anybody.
I do not think it should be the president has all power. Executive power is wrong unless there are checks and balances.
Keep your calls coming. We're at 877-8-MY-TAKE. With all the turmoil we've seen since the election and inauguration, some Americans may believe they are looking at a redesign of our democracy. Some poll numbers even suggest that a lot of Americans endorse such a redesign. Others may view the current turmoil as a series of overreaches and functional failures, partisan takeovers, and disrespect for traditions that have a history of working. This is why we are giving you an opportunity, for whatever reason, to redesign our democracy. How would you go about it? Empower some founding fathers and mothers, hold a convention right there in your kitchen, form a government with a better balance of power. What's not working now? Throw it out. What's broken now? How would you want to fix it? We asked our guests from this hour that same question. Eric Posner, who we heard from at the start of the show, thinks we might look across the pond for a system far better than our own.
I, like a lot of academics, really like the British Parliament. You elect your House of Representatives just like now, but then the leader of the party that controls the House of Representatives, the majority party, would become the president. And the nice thing about that is if he acts in an excessively crazy way, it's a simple matter for the party to have a vote of no confidence.
Every single day, Pippa Norris of Harvard University thinks about redesigning government and about how democracies function, how power is balanced, and the role of elections and public opinion in the shaping of government. She let us look into her big bag of fix.
So let's think about some structural solutions, things like incumbency. If you stand for office and you don't resign, your chances of being re-elected are overwhelming, 9 out of 10. That means essentially that you get back the people who depend on the party faithful, in particular when you draw districts, which means gerrymandered. So if we could reform districting, That would both make it more competitive, which means that members of Congress have to be more responsive to the public. And it would also mean they'd have to be responsive not just to the party faithful, but to others as well, which means a more moderate group would come in and you wouldn't have so many people on the extreme of both parties. And then there are some other reforms like that as well. Again, we know that in America, participation is remarkably low. 60% is the estimate in the last election of people turning out who were eligible to vote. So again, we know how to fix those issues. We can bring in more convenience voting. We can reduce the lines. We can improve both security and the facility that people can vote on the day, so long as we have certain safeguards on that sort of process. And then thirdly, I think we also need to think about the primaries. How do we end up with Donald Trump emerging as the successful candidate in the GOP? So I'm looking to a whole battery of sets of reforms which might look as though they're a bit far removed from the problem. They're a bit technical. They're not as heated, but the difficulty is always going to be getting both parties to vote for these. And of course, potentially also thinking about the implications for constitutional change, which is very difficult to do in the United States.
Your assumption here is that by reforming democracy in these various ways, that's going to reform the executive. How can we be absolutely sure of that?
You're changing the rules of the game by law and by regulatory procedure. What you then do is change the incentive for the politicians. And that means the pool of politicians who are there and who are potentially able to lead in both parties or in more than two parties. And so what you're doing is you're changing the political class. Now, clearly, you can obviously get people like Donald Trump who come in from outside that mainstream. But if you can change and make the parties themselves more moderate by giving them incentives to reach out across the aisle in their voting pattern, then you're less likely to get candidates coming through in the primaries and in the general election who are going to be either extreme on either one side or the other.
If there is a crisis in the United States, the executive has a level of discretion and a level of national security rationale that can somehow negate some of the things that you are talking about in the short term. How would you redesign or create some sort of constraints? Because we've already, you know, ignored Article 2, Section 8. Congress can declare war. That's been null and void for, you know, since World War II. What would you do there?
I mean, we have to say that there are kind of three barriers to executive overreach. The newspapers and the media, and you've got also the diversity of courts pushing back. And then, of course, you've also got civil society. I mean, you have to remember the mass demonstrations that were not just over the Women's March, which brought out something like 3.1 to 5.1 million people, but also the successive protests which have been ever since.
Part of our discussion in this hour has been about Gary Will's book, Bomb Power, which describes how the presence of the nuclear bomb and the way in which you basically have it in the hands of the president at all times has really changed the White House, changed the power of the presidency in a way that the framers could never, ever, ever have envisioned. Will you concede that that is the case?
Yes.
In the spirit of improvement of things, would you propose some more organized rethink of the way in which nuclear weapons are used, some sort of consultative process, something other than just a guy with some codes?
In a sense, John, you've answered it yourself, that of course it should be more than a guy with some codes and a particular individual president with their particular supporters and advisors in the White House. In a sense, we've lived with this because we've had a basic trust and confidence that the individuals in the White House have been thoughtful, serious politicians who are statespeople and who are interested in a wide range of foreign policy issues and are not irresponsible. It's very difficult to think about how one could reform the actual structure of decision making. It has to be one which is fairly fast and decisive. At the same time, there has to be some sort of consultation, presumably with the senior leadership within Congress, as a way of making sure that there's some checks and balances into those critical issues, just as there has to be a declaration of war, formally speaking, in Congress before we deploy troops. So there has to be some other forms of checks and balances which should be there for nuclear policy as well. Why we haven't had that in the past is because I think basically people have had enough confidence that things would work the way they were, but it's not adequate in uncertain times with an uncertain leadership.
Pippa Norris, who I could talk with forever, lectures in comparative politics at Harvard University. And that's our show. Thanks for joining us as we put a spotlight on the highest office in the land and the power it wields. We've heard from many of you on this subject. Savannah, Georgia, I'm tentatively feeling like our balance of powers are working. The takeaway, pun intended, for our nation, we have seriously curtailed civics and history in school, and now our lack of knowledge and appreciation for our system is showing. As always, we want to hear from you, so give us your take at 877-8MYTAKE or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. Happy President's Day. I'm John Hockenberry, and this is The Takeaway.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science. Neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing. Or
politics.
Country music.
Hockey.
Sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.